This audio recording is presented by Jews for Judaism. We are dedicated to keeping Jews Jewish. www.jewsforjudaism.ca.
Several years ago, I met a young man who was brought into my office and began teaching him some points on Torah. It was not long before I discovered that he was a Jewish Christian. And I have to admit, I was pretty flabbergasted. He was the first one that I had met face to face. When I asked him what made him tick, what were his beliefs, where'd they come from, what? So he explained to me, he gave me certain verses that I didn't have any difficulty answering. However, when he marched out of my office, I hadn't changed his beliefs. And I found it very disturbing. I did a little research and I found out that Christianity has actually made inroads into Judaism. So severe, in fact, that do you realize that there are more Jews in Jews for Yashka? That's our affectionate name for the God of the Christians. Than in all the yeshivas in the world. It's a horrifying fact that there are more Jews studying Christianity than studying Judaism. So I determined that it was important to find a way to refute them, and a way to discourage them, and a way to win back the Jews who knew nothing about Judaism. Several years later, I was sitting at Ben Gurion Airport waiting for someone to arrive, and suddenly a young man and a young woman came and sat down on either side of me, and they were smiling and they greeted me and said hello, and immediately they went into a missionary pitch. I looked at the boy, said a few words to him. He became immediately uncomfortable. I turned to the girl. I said a few words to her. She became uncomfortable. And as I turned around to look at the boy again, they were both off into the crowd and disappeared. One of the purposes of this tape, although not the main purpose, will be to teach you how to discourage a missionary from missionizing you. The main purpose of the tape is to give you the tools to be able to save Jewish people who have become involved in Christianity. The tape will be divided into four main categories. The first one I call defense, and that will deal with the verses from the Jewish Bible, which is known as Tanakh, that they tried to use to prove that Yeshua was the Mashiach, or even more than that. And we will show you how to defend and explain the Jewish point of view. The second part will start changing gear a little bit. We'll define what is the role of Mashiach and see whether he did it or not. The third part I call offense. And in it, we will bring not only verses from the Torah, but also verses from the New Testament to show either that Christianity is not a livable religion, that there are mistakes in it, that it perpetrates evil, and other ways that we can discourage him from believing or having faith in Christianity. Now, these three parts can only be used if you have a rational person before you. However, if you don't have a rational person, if you have a born-again or a freaked-out believer in front of you, someone who claims that Yashka visited him in person, then you probably will not be able to use rational arguments because they are totally irrational. And the fourth part will come in, and that's entitled Born Again. You may not be successful, totally successful, in dissuading a born-again Christian from practicing his religion. What you will be able to do is make him feel very uncomfortable with Christianity. You may go as far as taking all his clothes away and making him, in the name of Christianity, show how foolish a religion it is. If they're a missionary, we found that one of the most effective ways of keeping missionaries away from the Western Wall area, where our yeshiva is located, is to send fellows down there periodically when the missionaries come around, tell them to quote from Matthew, and ask for their money. And after they've gotten a couple hundred dollars at a shot, we found that there haven't been many missionaries around the wall in the last year or so after we've employed these techniques. Now, part one. The important principle to remember in part one is that our real purpose here is trying to get the Jewish Christian to listen to us. We have to first open line of communication. We provided a little card that's enclosed with the package. If more cards are needed, you can either send for additional cards, or of course you can write and copy the information down onto your own card. The card is made, especially the small size that it is, in order that it should be inserted into your wallet and kept with you, because you never know when you're going to come across a Christian. And this information really isn't important enough, unless you happen to be a crusader against Christianity. But it's not important enough that you should memorize all the verses and know exactly which chapter and verse of which book, and especially in the New Testament. So the idea is you just keep it in your pocket, and when you're approached by someone, you just take it out, and it acts as a sort of reminder of all the arguments that will be explained in detail in the tape. Now, another thing that I want to emphasize before we start is the tape is only for Jews. It's only because we're not interested in missionizing Christians. And if there are any Christians listening to the tape, right, I'm telling you right now, I'm not apologizing, I'm telling you right now, don't listen. The purpose of this tape is not to offend you, right, and it is not to get Christians to convert to Judaism. The purpose of the tape is that we feel that just as it's wrong for us to go out and missionize Christians, right, we feel that we would like that same mutual respect from Christians, that they shouldn't go out and missionize Jews. We're interested only in Jews. We want to educate our fellow brothers to know something about Judaism before we start looking somewhere else. Part one, defense. Point number one on the card is the Christians claim that there is a new covenant. The new covenant, they say, is the New Testament. And the verse that they use to prove that is Jeremiah chapter 31, verse 30, in which they say that it says there's a new covenant, which indeed, if you look at Jeremiah chapter 31, verse 30, you will see that there is indeed a new covenant mentioned. However, we tell them, look at Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 32 and 33. You'll see there that the term covenant and the term law is used. Obviously, they're two separate things. The word for law in Hebrew is Torah. The word for covenant, which according to the dictionary means a contract or agreement, is bris or brit. Now, what the verse really means is that God will make a new agreement with us to keep the law, which he has already given us, that law being the law of Moses. And that's what Jeremiah meant. The Christians try to twist it and say that God is going to create a new law. He didn't say that. He said a new agreement. Why is there a new agreement needed? We broke the first agreement. We didn't keep the law. We promised. Our agreement was we'd keep the law. And we haven't done such a good job. So in the days of the Messiah, We'll make a new agreement to keep the law, and this time the prophet tells us that we'll do it. Point number two, they say that Isaiah chapter 53 refers to J.C. And it's entitled, they entitled it, The Suffering Servant. And indeed, if you look at it, you'll see it does speak about a suffering servant. However, it doesn't refer to J.C. The truth of the matter is, we say it refers to the Jewish people. And if you'll look back and you'll start reading from the earlier chapters, you start at chapter 48, you'll see that it's talking about Am Yisrael, the Jewish people. We're called the servant. You see, Isaiah calls the Jewish people the servant of God. And as such, we have been. And anyone who knows our history understands that we are the suffering servant of God. We serve God, and we're despised by the nations, etc., etc. All the other prophecies that are in there. Now, were we to say, were we to agree with the Christians that it's talking about a man, because the poetic way in which it's phrased sounds like it's talking about a man, there is certainly no indication that it's talking about J.C. In fact, it seems it probably would be more appropriate to apply it to Isaiah himself, who was killed. Now, Isaiah was a servant of God. That everybody agrees. That the Christians agree as well. We don't agree with them that Yeshua was a servant of God, but they agree that Isaiah was a servant of God. He suffered, he was persecuted in his life. As a matter of fact, he was killed because he was a prophet. Now, before becoming embroiled in a debate over whose explanation is right, it's important to know that we're not trying to prove at this point that we have the right explanation. What we're trying to do is just answer them and show them that, well, Judaism has a different explanation, right? The truth of the matter is we could prove it, but we're not interested. At this point, we want to establish communication. We want to give them a chance to explain his or her point of view in order that they not feel that we're just attacking them. We want to establish with them a line of communication. One of the arguments that we could use to show at the end why the Jewish interpretation should be preferable is, suppose you wanted to find out about communism, and you had two options. You had two people standing before you. One of them claimed to be a student of Karl Marx. The other one claimed to have read Marx's writings. Now, the one who said he was a student of Karl Marx explained to you that the questions that you're raising now about the communist system, he raised with Karl Marx himself, and Karl Marx told him the explanation that he's now giving you. The other fellow, on the other hand, said, I read his writings, and I tell you that's not what he meant. What it really means, what he really meant is something else. Which person would you feel is more representative of the actually what Karl Marx said? Obviously, any thinking person realizes that it's the person who heard it from Marx himself. Well, Isaiah was a rabbi. And we rabbis taught it to our students who became rabbis. And Isaiah the rabbi taught it to his students, the sages. And they became the rabbis. And we have a line of tradition all the way mouth to mouth what Isaiah meant. He didn't mean the Christian interpretation. That's why the Jews never accepted him. The interpretation that we have is what Isaiah meant. The Christians, on the other hand, who came from a different perspective altogether, when they created their interpretation, it wasn't from a Jewish perspective. It wasn't that they had a tradition all the way back. It was nothing that was ever accepted before. They had created something new. It was their own invention. And although it may be a brilliant invention, it's wrong. You should not use that argument too much. Once is enough. Just make the point. Again, you don't want to necessarily win the debate at this point, because you'll scare him away. Point number three. They use Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14, which discusses the virgin birth. We explain to them, if you'll see the passage, you'll tell them, first of all, do you read Hebrew? Most times they'll say no. We tell them, well, look up the verse. The verse, it says, it uses the term Alma, which means a maiden. Now, there is a technical term in Hebrew for virgin. That word is Besula. The word Besula is not used here. Although Alma does not exclude virginity, nevertheless, it does not mean virginity. And when the scriptures wish to stress that point, they use the term Besula. Secondly, and more important, is take the whole prophecy of Isaiah chapter 7 in context. Tell them, keep reading, and you'll see that the prophet was speaking to King Ahaz, and that the prophecy was supposed to come true in the time of King Ahaz, which it did. And obviously, it wasn't referring to any virgin birth so many hundreds of years later. Point number four. They use Isaiah chapter 49, verses 1 to 5, and they say that because there are two terms used in the verses, Yisrael, Israel, and Beis Yaakov, that there must be two people who are being addressed, or two objects of the address. One being the Jewish people, the other one, who else could it be, except, you guessed it, Yashka. Okay? Now, the logic and the rationale of that certainly escapes me. But instead of arguing it on its reasonable grounds, it's much better to tell him, look at chapter 48, verse 1 in Isaiah, just one chapter before that, where it says, God says that Israel is Beis Yaakov, not that there are two separate things. Point number five. They use Psalms, chapter 22, verse number 17, for what they call the prophecy of the crucifixion. That's crucifixion spelled C-R-U-C-I-F-I-C-T-I-O-N. Complete fiction. We tell them that, of course, it's a complete fiction. We say, if you look at the word, at the verse in Hebrew, you see it says ka'ari. They translate the word as being pierced. Where they get that from is something which I will try to explain after I get this point across. But the word ka'ari means as a lion. It means they bound him like a lion, not they pierced him. Now, they get this term, pierced, because the New Testament, the people who made the New Testament, at the Council of Carthage in the year 397, that's, by the way, most Christians don't know that, was taken from the Hebrew, translated into Greek. The Greek was then translated into Latin, and the English version that we have before us now was translated from Latin into English. Somewhere along the line, right, they got confused. They made a mistranslation. But if you take the original book as it's written, King David wrote Psalms in Hebrew. He didn't write it in Greek, Latin, or English. You'll see that the word simply means as a lion. If you pick up a dictionary, you'll see that's what the word means. Point number six. They use Leviticus 17:11 and explain that there's a need for a blood offering. We tell them, look at the book of Yonah, the entire book of Yonah. There the people achieved total forgiveness, the city of Nineveh was spared, and not one offering was brought. It was only through repentance, through teshuva. That's the essence. number 7. They use Daniel, chapter 9, verse 25. And they say that it refers to Yashka. We say that it refers to Cyrus the Persian, who was called Mashiach. Now, if you think that's stretching it, and I admit it sounds like, boy, the Jews are really stretching it, take a look at chapter 45, verse 1 in the book of Isaiah. Thus says the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus. Now, the word anointed in Hebrew is Mashiach. In Hebrew, it reads L'Mashicho. Now, Cyrus wasn't alive yet. And this was a prophecy, and if you read until verse 13, you'll see the prophecy was that Cyrus was going to rebuild the temple, which he did. Cyrus was the one that initiated the work and helped the Jews build the temple. And that's what that prophecy is talking about. I would like to let you know that there is no panacea. You are dealing with people. If any moment you forget that, you won't be successful. You have to always be sensitive to his mood and to where he's coming from and give him a chance to talk. When he, in part number one, when he's telling you his proofs and he's talking about Christianity, listen. Try to be sensitive to the points that he feels are important. You'll know where to strike, you'll know what parts to emphasize, and you'll know where not to step to insult him. The purpose is not to insult him. The purpose is to demonstrate how ridiculous Christianity is. Now we begin part two. Part two is entitled What Mashiach is Supposed to Do. Point number one in part two, we tell them, look at Isaiah chapter 11, verses 1 through 12. There we'll find a prophecy that says, the wolf shall dwell with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and the calf and the lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them, and the cow and the bear shall feed their young, shall lie down together, the lion shall eat straw like the ox. I will skip a little bit. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Well, my friends, it didn't happen. That was 2,000 years ago. It didn't happen. Certainly not in his day. Anyone who knows a little bit of history, you know what happened in his day. Point number two is that the prophet Zechariah, whom they call Zechariah, stated in chapter 9, verses 9 and 10, rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion, shout aloud, O daughter of Jerusalem, lo, your king comes to you, triumphant and victorious is he. By the way, he wasn't. You know what happened to him. Humble and riding on an ass, on the colt, the foal of an ass, I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the warhorse from Jerusalem, and the battle bow shall be cut off, and he shall command peace to the nations. Well, he didn't command peace to the nations. His dominion shall be from sea to sea and from river to the ends of the earth. And in case you think that he didn't command peace to the nations, we'll have to wait to part three, where I'll point out exactly what he did command. Point number three in part two. Well, depending upon what kind of Bible you have before you, if you have a Jewish one, it's Malachi chapter 3, the last three psukim. If you happen to have a New Testament version in front of you, which, by the way, is probably a good thing to do when you're debating these people, so they don't think you're pulling a fast one on them, it's chapter 4, verses 4 and 5. That's the book of Malachi. And there it says that before the Mashiach comes, Elijah the prophet is going to come and announce his coming. Well, Elijah never came, and we're still waiting for him. They say that Elijah came Well, we're a little confused. I mean, we'd like to know who Elijah is. So they tell us it was John. John the Baptist. Which is very strange to me. Because if you look at the book of John, not that you should, but if you happen to have one there, and you look at the book of John, chapter 1, verse 21, let's go back to the beginning of the paragraph, which is actually verse 19, chapter 1. We don't want to do what the missionaries usually do, try to take things out of context, and just read it, what it says. And this is the testimony of John when the Jews sent priests and Levites from Jerusalem to ask him, "Who are you?" He confessed. He did not deny, but confessed, "I am not the Yashka." And they asked him, "What then? Are you Elijah?" He said, "I am not." I guess he wasn't Elijah. But he didn't finish there. "Are you the prophet?" He answered, "No." That's pretty good. I mean, obviously, he wasn't. Unless he was a liar. Point number 4. Psalms chapter 72, verses 7 to 11. In his days may righteousness flourish. Well, they didn't flourish in his days. And peace abound till the moon be no more. No comment. May he have dominion from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. May his foes bow down before him and his enemies lick the dust. Doesn't sound like that happened. May the kings of Tarshish and the isles render him tribute. May the kings of Sheba and Seba bring gifts. May all kings, fall down before him. All nations, serve him. Needless to say, that prophecy also didn't come true. Next one, point number 5, is Daniel. Chapter 7, verse 14. And to him was given dominion and glory and kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. Well, he never had the dominion, and he's dead. There are many more verses like this. We don't want to labor the point that he didn't fulfill the prophecies of Mashiach. The only answer that the Christians try to use is they say that there's going to be a second coming, which I suspect comes from the quote in Isaiah, where it says that God will send his hand a second time over. Now, that obviously refers to not a second coming, but the first coming. The first time that God stretched out his hands and brought in the exile was when they rebuilt the second temple. Now we need a second time. That's what we're waiting for. And that's what they were waiting for in the days of Yeshu, because the prophecy had already been fulfilled by that time. They were in Israel already. Now, you don't have to argue with him on the second coming. What you do is you just raise an eyebrow and say, "Oh, come on, you don't really believe it, do you?" I mean, that's the point. You don't really believe it. One thing's for sure. He didn't fulfill these prophecies. There's no reason to think that he's the Messiah because he didn't fulfill any of the messianic prophecies. So whatever makes you think he's the Messiah, well, he didn't do these. And if you think that the other prophecies that you claim about him refer to him, well, they should also apply to the second coming. So the point of emphasis that we want to make is, well, admit to me that he didn't do it yet. You say he'll do it next time, that's okay, but get him to admit that he didn't do it yet. And now we're up to part 3. Part 3 is a much more aggressive part than anything we've done so far. If there are any Christians listening at this point, even though I've warned you before not to listen, and you may not take my warning now either, at least I'm going to offer you the courtesy of turning it off right now. My intention is not to smear Christianity or get you to change your religion, but I'm going to hopefully inoculate any Jews who are listening to the pleas and the deceit of missionaries that claim that Christianity is what it really is not. And therefore, I'll ask you to turn to part three, point number one. You should ask them at this point, how do you know that Yeshka was a prophet? They will probably use Deuteronomy chapter 18, verses 18 and 19. Now, there's a good chance they don't know that's how they know it. They just accept it on faith. But that's what it says in the New Testament. That's the proof it's given in the New Testament. So you tell them, well, you know how you know? Because it says Deuteronomy 18, 18 and 19. And when you look at it, they will see that it says that a prophet will arise among the people like you. God is speaking to Moses. And they will say probably, oh, yeah, that's right. That's how we know it. Because who else was like Moses except Yashka? But we tell them, keep reading. Just keep reading the prophecy. And you'll see that it says that a prophet who makes a wrong prediction is not a prophet. He's a false prophet. That means not that he's a real prophet and he's making a mistake. It means he's not really a prophet. He's faking you out. You don't have to be afraid of him, and you don't have to listen to him. As a matter of fact, he should be killed. Make sure he articulates the fact that if a prophet makes a prediction that doesn't come true, he's not a prophet. And then ask him, suppose I could find someone in the New Testament, one of the apostles, who made a prediction that didn't come true. What would God be saying about him? I'm not saying that there is such a thing, but suppose, theoretically, we would find such a thing. Would that not, in fact, mean that prophet is false? Get him to admit, at least, that it would be very uncomfortable if you could find such a thing. And then tell him to turn to the book of Mark, chapter 1, verse 15. And it states that the kingdom of God is at hand. Now, who was the prophet that said that? It was none other than Yeshu himself. So you take out the quote and you tell him, look, Yeshu himself said the kingdom of God is at hand. You know, that was like almost 2,000 years ago. You know, his hand wasn't that big. You get him to see that the prophecy didn't come true. Well, they may try to squirm a little bit and say, well, it doesn't really mean right now. It means in God's time. You know, after all, it says in Psalms that one day in God's time is like 1,000 years. So you say, but that's only 1,000 years. This is 2,000 years. If that's not enough, you tell them to turn to the book of Revelations, chapter 21, verse 7, where he said, not at hand, but he said, behold, I'm coming soon. Now, at hand and it's soon. I mean, we know what soon is, right? Well, we're still waiting, and he hasn't come. Get them to admit that it's at least a difficulty. If you can't get them to admit that, then you know he's not really honest and he's not really listening to you. Part 3, point number 2. It's good to ask them at this point whether they would agree that someone who says that God is a liar or is fickle, right, is a blasphemer. And although they may be a little suspicious of your motives, they probably will agree. They'll probably agree. Now, when they do, you tell them, turn to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 29, verse 28. They may have it in a different verse. And there it says, all the laws of forever. The verse says, all the laws of forever. I'll read the verse. It says, in the New Testament version of the Tanakh, it's 29:29. The secret things belong to the Lord our God, but the things that are revealed, which is the Torah, by the way, which you'll point out later in the verse, belong to us and to our children forever. You know, forever means forever. That we may do, that means do, all the words of this law. Now in Hebrew, the word for this law is HaTorah HaZos. So it seems clear that God is telling us that all the laws are forever. So you ask him, do you wear tefillin? Do you wear tzitzis? When he admits that he doesn't, you ask him, how is it possible you don't do it? So he'll tell you, well, the New Testament took away the need for the law, for practicing the law. So you tell him, so are you saying that God is a liar or fickle? He said all the laws are forever. And now you say he's changing his mind? What, he lied the first time in Deuteronomy when he said all the laws are forever? Right? He knew he was going to change it with the New Testament. Right? But he said it anyway. So you're saying he's a liar? Or are you saying that he didn't realize it? Right? He didn't know the future? Or are you saying that, well, he couldn't make up his mind? At that time he thought it was good. He said that it says forever. But then he changed his mind and he's not sure of himself. I mean, what are you saying? But besides that, you know, Yashka also taught that all the laws have to be kept. You tell him, turn to the book of Matthew, chapter 5, verse 17. There he said, not one jot or tittle will pass away from the law. And he goes on to say that anybody who teaches that the law not be fulfilled or kept, even the smallest commandment, that person will be the least in the kingdom of heaven. That's what he said himself. Now, not only that, he also commanded us to follow another Torah dictum. What is that? It says in Deuteronomy 17, verses 8 through 14, that you have to listen to the Torah sages of your generation. When something will come up, a question that will perplex you and you won't know whether it's this way or that way, then you should go to the priests and to the judges of your time and do whatever they tell you. And that refers to the rabbis, the sages. And even Yashka said so. In the book of Matthew, chapter 23, verses 2 and 3, he said, practice and observe whatever they tell you. I mean, what could he do? That's what the Torah said. Even he admitted that was referring to the rabbis. He was telling the people, listen to what they say, but don't do like they do. But he admitted, you have to listen to the rabbis. Now, why don't you wear tefillin? Why aren't you wearing tzitzis? I mean, even he said so. Now, one thing that he did say was that anybody who teaches even the smallest of the laws is not important or doesn't have to be done is the least in the kingdom of heaven. Now, suppose I could find one of the apostles that did just that. What would you say? Where would his place in heaven be, according to Yashka? Right? And indeed, if you look at Acts chapter 13, verse 39, you'll see that Paul, who is the author of Acts, calls for, well, you don't need the law anymore. And he also says circumcision is not so necessary. These aren't small things. Yet Yashka said anybody who teaches the smallest one of them doesn't have to be fulfilled. He's the least in the kingdom of heaven. So at least now we know certainly from a Jewish and a Christian point of view, where Paul's place is in the kingdom of heaven. But I'd like to go a step farther. I'd like to find out where Yashka's place is in the kingdom of heaven. So let's go look at the book of Mark, chapter 2, Verse 27. Now, we don't want to take this out of context. We'll read it. We'll go back to the beginning of this paragraph again, wherever it's possible and it's not too time-consuming. I would like to read from the beginning of the chapter so that I don't take it out of context. From verse 23, on one Sabbath, he was going through the grain fields, and as they began their way, his disciples began to pluck ears of grain. And the Pharisee said to him, "Look, why are they doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath?" In other words, they were profaning the Sabbath. Now, the Sabbath is not a little one, it's a big one. And he said to them, "Have you never read what David did when he was in need and was hungry? He and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God with Abiathar the high priest, and ate the bread of the presence, which is not lawful for any but the priest to eat, and also gave it to those who were with him?" And he said to them, now this is the point, this is his own teaching. "The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord even over the Sabbath." Well, I ask you, where's his place in the kingdom of heaven? Incidentally, anyone who carefully reads Shmuel, the book of Samuel, will see that the account brought here in the New Testament is not accurate. And rather than go into a detailed Bible comparison or explanation class, which will detract from the purpose of the tape, it's important to just see from a Jewish perspective. You should read the difference there was that, first of all, David was being chased and his life was endangered. He was at war. And there was what's called pikuach nefesh, for self-preservation. Here, they were just strolling through the grain fields when they decided not only to steal it, but to violate the Shabbos. So, the situation was completely different. The point that you want them to admit is that God said all the laws are forever. And Yashka said no one has the right to change any of the laws, let alone teach that any of the laws aren't important. And if anybody should even teach that one of the minor laws aren't important, that he's the least in the kingdom of heaven. Yet he himself and Paul both did so. Point number three. The lineage of Yashka is one of the foundations of the Christian faith. The Torah, the Tanakh, teaches us that the Mashiach has to be descendant of the house of David. And therefore, the Christians went out of their way to try to trace Yashka's lineage back to the house of David, which, if it could not be done, obviously he's not the Messiah. So we have two places where the lineage is traced. The first one is in the book of Matthew, chapter 1, verses 15 and 16. Come right down to the end of the line. And it takes us right up to Yashka. Now, Yashka's mother was Mary, and her husband's name was Joseph. So it goes, Joseph was the son of Jacob, was the son of Matan, was the son of Eliezer. In the book of Luke, chapter 3, verse 23, it says that Joseph was not the son of Jacob, but the son of Eli, who was the son of Matan, who was the son of not Eliezer, but Levi. What this proves is that, according to them, Joseph was descended from the house of David. However, it seems to be there are two Josephs here. They have different fathers and different great-grandfathers. Obviously some confusion. The point I want to make is, if Joseph, as they claim, was not the father of Yeshu, of Yashka, then why bring down the lineage? Then all you've proven is that Yashka wasn't descended from the house of David. So Christians will try to say that Mary was descended from the house of David. So there are two things we answer. One is, you see, even from the New Testament, that lineage goes after the father, because they only traced the fathers. They didn't trace the mothers. And secondly, if that was true, then why did the New Testament waste the words tracing Joseph when he could have used that space for tracing Mary's lineage? Obviously, it's a bad answer. Now that we're on this point, it's important to know something about the birth of Yashka. We spoke a little bit in part one about the virgin birth. I'd like to go into it a little bit more now. This lineage and the virgin birth tie in together. Now, this is not my story. This is the story in Matthew. It's true I may fill in a few details that are not there, but I'm basically sticking to the story. You could check it out in Matthew. Mary was betrothed to Joseph. That means that she was married to him. The only thing is, they hadn't consummated the marriage yet. In the times of the Talmud, in the times that this story took place, the custom was that when a woman became betrothed, she accepted the ring from her husband, and she was now a complete married woman and liable to the death penalty if she becomes an adulteress. And she would go and live in her father's house until her husband completed building their home and taking care of all the needs to be able to set up his own household. And then he would come a year later and take his wife and consummate the marriage in their own home. That was called Nisuin. Well, Mary was an Arusa. That means she was betrothed. And while she was in this state, and Joseph was not with her but building the home, he heard that she had become pregnant. Now, he knew he didn't do it, so he became outraged, as any decent Jew would be in those days. And he wanted to take her to court. But before he could, the New Testament tells us that he saw a vision, and in it the Holy Ghost told him, you know, don't worry, you know, I did it. Which, of course, made him feel a lot better. And when Yeshua was born, he was considered by the rabbis to be a mamzer. A mamzer is prohibited, according to the Torah, from marrying anyone he chooses. In other words, he has a limit upon whom he can marry, which people within the Jewish people. The reason that he was adjudicated a mamzer was, according to Jewish law, we can't accept the testimony of visions. I mean, here's a woman comes before us, she's pregnant, she admits that her husband is not the father, and he denies paternity. Now, it seems to me that the two lineages come into play here. Apparently, there must have been two different Josephs. One Joseph the husband, and Joseph the father. It's true, that's my theory. It may not be historically accurate, but at least that might explain the two different theories, or two different lineages connected to Yashka through Joseph. Two different Josephs. One the father, and one the husband. Now, what this all created was a state that Yashka hated the sages. They were the ones who stuck to the law of God. They were the ones who were faithful to God's word no matter what. They were the ones that couldn't be swayed, bought, bribed, anything away from the word of God. So they upheld the Torah, and he hated them for it. And that's why he railed against them, and that's why he called them vipers and villains, and that's why he promised that the harlots and the muhsanim were the tax gatherers, that they would come, they would be together with him in the kingdom of heaven. But the sages, the Pharisees, who by the way were people like Hillel and Rabbi Yochanan and Zakkai, these holy, pious men, they were going to burn because he hated them. Now, because of this hatred, A lot of anti-Semitism was bred in the New Testament. But before I get into the anti-Semitism, I would like to point out that Paul, one of the later apostles, one of the later fathers of the Christian church, realized how stupid the genealogies were. And he told in the letter called Titus in the New Testament, chapter 3, verse 9, he said, avoid stupid genealogies. That means when people start talking facts about the New Testament, avoid talking about it. Because he realized how stupid the whole book was. Now, because of Yeshka's attitude towards the sages and towards Torah true Jews in general, he bred the seeds for anti-Semitism. And we can see that was a theme in the New Testament. Paul says that the Jews crucified Yashka. Paul, the Jew, writes, the Jews crucified Yashka. Right? That's in the book of Acts, chapter 2, 36. Matthew explains it wasn't the Jews, it was the Romans that did it. Doesn't everybody know it was the Romans? Yet Paul went out of his way to point out, oh, it was those Jews. If you're a Jew, didn't you ever have anybody, a Christian kid, come up to you, maybe when you were a kid, and say, you killed our God? You never heard that? If it didn't happen to you, you don't know somebody that was said to? And then later on, in the same book, in Acts 10:39, he says, the Jews killed him by hanging him on a tree. The same man, says, on one hand they crucified him, on the other hand they hung him on a tree. And in Matthew, he says, his blood is on our heads. It's important to know something about the Christian persecutions of the Jews, to understand the ramifications of his words, and to get a better understanding of the real teachings of Christianity. While on one hand they do preach love, on the other hand they preach other things that are not love. Now, there were many events of Christians oppressing, killing, pillaging, and raping Jewish communities. In the city of Worms, in the year 1096, the Crusaders began a practice which they continued in other Jewish communities when they saw that it was so successful. After they had murdered, pillaged, and raped the Jewish victims who were defenseless, and what was their crime? They refused to accept forced baptism. That means they stuck to their principles as Jews, and they knew that to accept the idolatry of Christianity, that God called upon them to give their lives. And they were willing to do it, and they did. It was not enough. One further atrocity had to be heaped upon them, and that was that the practice of stripping the bodies of all the Jews and letting the bodies rot until the communities surrounding Worms would come up with enough money to buy baptized clothes to allow the Jews to be buried in. Now, these people who did this, they weren't the rabble masses. They were the holy men, the bishops, the monks, the priests. The church created the ghetto in France. It was Christian religious leaders that created the badge of shame, the yellow badge of shame that was the forerunner of the yellow star that the Nazis forced the Jews to wear before they exterminated them in Europe. Not so strange bedfellows, the Christians and the Nazis. In 1244, Duke Ferdinand of Germany had to issue a decree that is so startling that it gets us to understand how the Christians behaved, the average Christian. He had to make a specific decree that it's forbidden to violate Jewish maidens. Now, can you appreciate what that means? Do you know what it was like before the decree? These are the Christians, you know, the religion of love, moral people, right? A special decree. Now, Duke Ferdinand wasn't a representative of the church. He wasn't even a religious person. But he saw it was morally repugnant to him what was going on. In 1306, the Jews were expelled from France. Now, don't think it was just the Roman Catholics that had a monopoly on this type of behavior. The Greek Orthodox in Poland wiped out the Jews in the Chelmniki massacres in the 1600s. Over 100,000 Jews were wiped out in a short period of time. And even righteous people like Martin Luther, he preached that synagogues are dens of thieves and villains, and it's a big mitzvah to burn them down. His followers did exactly that. Now, we have them to a point where we're going to use an important argument. This is one of the most important arguments you can use against the missionary. You tell him that this is Christianity. Christianity is not a religion of love. It seems to be a religion of hate, war, pillage, rape, all the things that Christians have done for the last 1500 years since the religion was founded. Now, their standard answer is, those people aren't real Christians. A real Christian wouldn't do that. So we tell them, look at Matthew chapter 7, verses 15 to 20. You'll see there that your God says that's not so. What does he say? I'm going to start from verse 15. Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You will know them by their fruits. Are grapes gathered from thorns or figs from thistles? So every sound tree bears good fruit, but the bad tree bears evil fruit. A sound tree cannot bear evil fruit, nor can a bad tree bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus you will know them by their fruits. So I tell you, my friend, he's telling me, don't listen to the wolves that are coming in sheep's clothing to tell you that these aren't real Christians. He's saying, look at their fruits. Well, the fruits of Christianity are in the history books, not the Jewish history books. Not only did they kill Jews, they killed each other. They had 30 years' wars and War of the Roses and the Protestants against the Roman Catholics and the Roman Catholics against the Greek Orthodox. They've been killing each other. Christians have been killing Christians. Those are the fruits. Those are the fruits of Christianity. Now, according to him, he has come up with the biggest and most articulate condemnation of Christianity, something I couldn't think of on my own. And it's important to get that point across. Part number 3.4. Christian faith is basically an anti-intellectual faith, and you can see from its founding fathers why. So anti-intellectual, in fact, that a man by the name of John Tyndale, who was the first person that had the audacity to translate the New Testament into English in 1535, so that common people could read it, was fortunate enough to die before the church could get their hands on him. Unfortunately for his friend, a man by the name of Rogers, who collaborated with him, he was burned at the stake, alive. For what? The atrocity of making the New Testament readable to the common people. Now, what was so terrible about that? Well, we'll point out a few things in the New Testament, and you'll start to see why the New Testament is such a dangerous thing for people to read. Now, they didn't stop just with Rogers alone. You know, I guess they must have had another match left over in the pack. So they dug up the bones of John Tyndale and burned them at the stake, too. Point number five. Contrary to popular belief, Yeshko was not a high scholar. It says in the book of John, and Christianity admits to this point, chapter 7, verse 15, it says clearly that J.C. didn't study. He wasn't a man who studied. And as far as Peter and John, two of the apostles, in the book of Acts, chapter 4, verse 13, it says they were illiterate. And these were the forefathers of the church. Point number six. Christians claim that the reason you don't do the Torah today is that it can't be done. It's too hard. You can't do it. However, we say, look what God said in Deuteronomy 30, 11 to 14. He said, it can be done. It's not in heaven that somebody has to go up and bring it down. It's not across the sea. You can do it. It's within your reach, and you can do it. Point number seven. Remember we learned some of the prophecies that discussed what the Messiah is supposed to do, like in Zechariah and in Psalms, where it said that the Messiah is supposed to bring peace. Well, let's take a look in the New Testament and see what Yeshko said he was bringing. Turn to the book of Luke, chapter 12, verse 51. Do you think that I've come to give peace on earth? No, I tell you, but rather division. For henceforth, in one house, there will be divided five. Three against two, and two against three. They will be divided father against son, and son against father. Mother against daughter, and daughter against her mother. Mother-in-law against her daughter-in-law, and daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. Sounds like a very noble man. Obviously, he wasn't the Messiah, and it's important to stress that point to him. Here, the Messiah is supposed to bring peace. He was coming to bring division, in his own words. Point number eight. I entitled this, Paul, Hypocrite Number One. Now, in order to see why Paul deserves such a fitting title, I ask you to turn to the book of Corinthians 2. Chapter 4, verse 2. And you'll hear a pious man speaking pious words. We have renounced disgraceful, underhanded ways. We refuse to practice cunning or to tamper with God's word, but by the open statement of the truth, we would commend ourselves to every man's conscience in the sight of God. In other words, the Gospels are so true and so obvious that we don't have to resort to cunning, to deceit, or trickery. We wouldn't do such a thing. We wouldn't do such a despicable thing. Now, turn to the book, Corinthians 1, chapter 9, verse 20. Now, remember, this is the same man speaking, the same man that wouldn't resort to cunning under any circumstances. To the Jews I became as a Jew in order to win the Jews. To those under the law I became as one under the law, though not being under the law myself, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law I became as one outside the law, not being without the law toward God, but under the law of Yeshko, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. Paul, hypocrite number one. Now, I'd like to begin on point number nine, a new subject. I would like to discuss Yeshko the man. Not Yeshka the God, not Yeshka the Messiah, Yeshka the man. I'd like to examine the type of man that he was. Many people have a misconception that he really was a very good person. Only he wasn't really a God, really he wasn't Messiah, but he was a good man, he preached good things. And most Jews, even if they aren't into Christianity, accept that. I would like to examine the New Testament's picture of Yashka. Now, according to Jewish tradition, he wasn't such a nice fellow. After all, he was one of our boys and he lived with us, and we know better. But let's see what his friends, the Christians, spoke about him and explained how he behaved. We know that God commands us to honor our parents. And any decent person, Jew or non-Jew, understands that it's an important thing. Any parent, Jew or non-Jew, certainly wants his children to honor them, himself. And any child knows that it's a proper thing to honor his parents. Let's take a look at this man, Yashka. In the book of John, chapter 2, verse 4, we'll get a picture of a man who's rude to his own mother. Here, in walks Yashka to a party that his mother is at. Now, what the Rebbetzin is doing at a party, I don't know, where men and women are drinking together. You can imagine the kind of party, what was going on there. And his mother tells him, look, we're out of wine. I mean, they must have really been drinking. They're out of wine. And she asked her son to perform a minor miracle and turn water into wine. What was his reaction? He said, John 2:4, O woman, what have you to do with me? You understand, that's his mother he's talking to. Suppose you saw it in the street. The man is walking with an old lady, and he turned to her and he said, oh, woman, what would you have to... What kind of person would you think of him? Not too good. You wouldn't think too highly of a person like that, would you? There's another aspect of his character. The man of love. Let's see what kind of man of love he is. Let's take a look at Matthew 10:34. And keep in mind whether you'd like this man boarding in your house, let alone being part of your family. Do not think that I have come to bring peace on earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to set a man against his father. That's important. That first part of the verse is real important. For I have come to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's foes will be those of his own household. He who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. A little bit of arrogance, I'd say. And he who loves his son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he who does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Take a look at Luke chapter 14, verse 26. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. I'll tell you one thing, I wouldn't like him living in my house. Now, compare this man of love to the Jewish teaching. Compare it to Leviticus 19, verses 17 and 18. You shall not bear a grudge. You shall love your fellow man as yourself. And compare it to the rabbinic teachings of the people, the Pharisees, that he railed against. Look at the ethics of the fathers. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Prachya said, give everyone the benefit of the doubt. That's chapter 1, Mishnah 5. Shammai said, receive every man in a kindly way. That's chapter 1, Mishnah 15. And the Talmud relates about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai that he was so friendly and so kind that no one, no Gentile, no Jew, could get the drop on him to say good morning first. He always beat everybody to the punch and with a smile would say good morning. That was the Jewish way. And so on, and so on, and so on, many, many more. And it's important to realize that, that Judaism is the religion of love. In Matthew chapter 21, verses 18 and 19, we meet a different aspect of Yeshka's personality. He says the following. Well, we're told a story. In the morning, as he's returning to the city, he was hungry. Now, how a god is hungry, it's akasha. And seeing a fig tree by the wayside, he went to it and found nothing on it but leaves. And he said to it, may no fruit ever come from you again. And the tree withered and died. Well, that certainly reflects a certain kind of personality. Here, this poor tree is just standing there. And he wanted a fig from it. And it didn't have any. Poor tree. Imagine how bad the tree felt. So he cursed the tree. What kind of man is that? Can you imagine how vicious he is? But if you think that's bad, then take a look back in Matthew chapter 8, verses 21 and 22. This one will make your hair stand on end, even if you don't have any hair. Another of the disciples said to him, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. You understand what's going on now. Here's a man, a disciple, came to his teacher with respect and needed to unburden something. His father had just died. And all he wanted to do, he wanted the opportunity to bury his father before the teacher and students moved on to a new place. And what was the reaction of this compassionate man who, if he was a Jew, would have said, sit down and relax. We will bury your father for you. Don't mourn too much. What did he say? Verse 22. But Yeshka said to him, follow me and leave the dead to bury their own dead. How's that for a man of compassion, a man of love? Another side of his personality is his megalomania. Megalomania is his desire to be considered a god. He who speaks on his own authority seeks his own glory. That's what he said in the book of John, chapter 7, verse 18. Yet, in John, just one chapter later, in chapter 8, verse 12, he said, I am the light of the world. Now, can you imagine, you meet somebody in the street, and he smiles at you, and he says, listen, I have some good news for you. I just want to let you know that I am the light of the world, right? There's another story in Matthew chapter 26, verse number 6, and read. Now, when Yeshka was at Bethany, in the house of Simon the leper, a woman came up to him with an alabaster jar, very expensive ointment, and she poured it on his head as he sat at the table. But when the disciples saw it, they were indignant, saying, why this waste? For this ointment might have been sold for a large sum and given to the poor. They were right. But Yeshka, aware of this, said to them, why do you trouble the woman? For she has done a beautiful thing to me. For you always have the poor with you, but you will not always have me. In pouring this ointment on my body, she has done it to prepare me for burial. Truly I say to you, wherever this gospel is preached in the whole world, what she has done will be told in memory of her. Now, this is a man that clearly had double standards. Everyone else he told not to do such a thing. But when he was the recipient of expensive ointments, he always found an excuse why it shouldn't be sold to the poor. I mean, the poor were still suffering. It's true that there will be poor when he's gone, But they were still suffering. I mean, a man who really feels the suffering of the poor, how could he waste such extravagance on himself? So he wouldn't have had ointment on himself to be buried. So much for Yashka the man. Now, that's all he was. He was a man, and not a very good man at that. Point number 10. The New Testament often contradicts itself, as can be seen from the following points. They're blatant misquotes, where it says in Acts chapter 7, verse 14, that 75 souls came down to Egypt. And if you look in the Chumash, if you look in Exodus, or if you look at the end of Bereshis, you'll see that it was only 70. And in Acts 7:16 says that Abraham was buried in Shechem. Well, he was really buried in Hebron. And if you're not sure about it, which is right, you can go to Hebron today and visit Abraham's tomb. There is none in Shechem. Everybody knows it's one of the tourist attractions in Israel today, the Tomb of the Patriarchs, which is in Hebron. To sum up part number 3, it's important to know that there is not one good doctrine in Christianity that wasn't taken from Judaism. And all the rest of Christianity is paganism, including the sacraments and the virgin births and all the other Greek and Roman and pagan ideas that were put onto Christianity. We have tried to dispel a lot of the illusions about Christianity being the religion of love, which it is not. We've demonstrated that it has gone against God's will, and that the man who made up the religion, or the men who made up the religion, have trampled on God's word and have blasphemed to the heights of the heavens. And it's important for anyone who seriously considers Christianity to be made aware of these points. Now, up until now, we've been accepting the fact that the person before us is reasonable. And the first 3 parts, indeed, should only be used if you feel that he's reasonable. However, if you start speaking to him, and you discover immediately that he is totally unreasonable, that whatever you say, he just blanks out. Either he starts playing with his rosary beads, or his pupils become dilated, and he starts saying Hare Krishna or something, then you realize that he probably is a born-again Christian. Now, born-again Christians feel that the most grievous sin that a man can do is use his mind and be rational. That faith is the only thing that counts. Now, if you happen to meet a born-again Christian, there's only one way of dealing with him. First, confront him. Christianity is evil. It has evil doctrines. One of the most evil doctrines in Christianity is resist not evil. You know what that means? That means that if you come home one evening and your parents are being mugged, if you're a good Christian, you won't resist evil. You'll trust in the Lord, you'll do other things, but that's what it says in Matthew chapter 5, verse 39, resist not evil. And you see specifically from the context that he's even referring to physical evil, where a person is being struck. So no matter what the Christians try to do to twist it, that's their doctrine. So you say to him, you mean to tell me that's what Christianity preaches? Would he do that? Would he do that if his parents were being mugged, if someone he loved was being mugged? He'd just sit there? You know what Judaism says? Leviticus 19, verse 16. Osamud al-dam reyecha. Don't stand by the blood of your brother. That means if you see someone in need, you get there and you help them. You're walking in the street and you see somebody being mugged, you help. You don't walk by and resist not evil. You resist evil with all your might. How else is evil going to be stopped? It's because of the Christian doctrine that there is so much evil in the world today. Because Christians aren't interested in resisting evil. Apparently, they seem much more interested in propagating it. Now, there's another doctrine of Christianity that you can use, and I've used this successfully. As a matter of fact, this New Testament that I have here is one of many that I've taken away using the following technique. It says in Matthew chapter 5, verse 42, "Give to him who begs from you, and do not refuse him who would borrow from you." In addition to that, you can look in the book of Luke, chapter 6, verse 30. It says, "Give to everyone who begs from you, and of him who takes away your goods, do not ask them again." So it's clear that this is a principle of Christianity. So what you do is, first thing you ask him for his wallet. Beg from him his wallet. It says, "Do not refuse he who begs from you." So beg from him. "I beg you, may I have your wallet?" So if he's a good Christian, he'll take his wallet and give it to you. And you'll tell him, Luke says you can't ask for it back. Right? So you can't ask for it back. Well, you look in the wallet, you see what you got there. If you feel it's enough for a day's work, you could stop there. You can go home. If, however, you feel that you want to go farther, you could ask him for his camera, for his glasses. I mean, I've gone so far as to ask people for their pants and their shirts and their wallets and their hats and their shoes and their socks and their watches, and I've taken them all away and I've sent them out in the street without them, unless they admit it's a stupid doctrine. Usually they do. Sometimes they offer four-letter epithets to prove that the religion of Christianity is not a holy religion. Completely unsolicited from me. Exactly how you use it depends on you. One thing that you can hope to do using this, and this is the major thing, is to get him to focus on the fact that it's ridiculous. He's gotten into Christianity on an emotional level. You have to get him out on an emotional level. You can't reason with him. You can't explain the verses. It means nothing. They're fencing techniques for him. You have to hit him here. You have to do this to him in order to shock him and to realize that it's not a livable religion. It's a ridiculous religion. Perhaps then, and only then, he'll be susceptible to the first three parts. So, if you're unfortunate enough to be in an area where missionaries are working, or you happen to know Jews who are involved in Christianity, if you use these principles correctly, and if you don't try to overpower him too soon, and if you don't try to scare him away, but gain his confidence, there is a very good chance that you can get him out of it. Now, in summation, so I wish anyone who tries to use these methods success, because if you have to try to use it, it means that there is some Jewish person in need. Again, if there's been a Christian listening to this, despite my warning not to, I'm not going to apologize to you. You deserve no apology. I told you not to listen, and you shouldn't have. But I again want to let you know, my intention isn't to convert you. And if you're interested in Judaism now, think about these things. Think about these things well before you come. And if you think that it was done in a vein of hatred, it was not. We are asking from you the same respect we've been giving you for all generations. Leave us alone, and we'll leave you alone. And for the Jews that are listening to the tape, we are trying to do something which is save our own children. What you're doing is not destroying Christianity. What you're doing is saving the Jewish people. If you have to destroy Christianity, the idolatry of Christianity, in order to do it, then that's the mitzvah. And don't feel bad about it. Don't feel guilty about it. Your intention should not be to destroy Christianity. There's certainly better things to do with your time. But if there's a Jew who's in need, and the way to do it is this, and it's been a proven method, it has worked, then feel that you're doing the right thing.
Jews for Judaism hopes that you have found this audio recording to be helpful and informative. Jews for Judaism is an international organization dedicated to countering the multi-million-dollar efforts of Christian missionary groups that target Jews, the impact of destructive cults and Eastern religions, and the growing rate of intermarriage that is devastating the Jewish community. Jews for Judaism achieves its goals through one-on-one counseling services and educational programs and materials that connect Jewish people to the spiritual depth, beauty, and wisdom of Judaism. Please contact Jews for Judaism if we can help you. www.jewsforjudaism.ca. Keeping Jews Jewish.